Jeff, why did you decide to write this book, Becoming Amish? What was it that captured your imagination?
Well, it kind of goes back to actually a magazine story that I wrote not long after the economic crash. And I work for Traverse Magazine, and we're based in northern Michigan. And I was explaining to our team that a friend of mine had grown up in mainstream America, had most recently lived in Grosse Pointe, and had become Amish. And I was thinking to me that it would be maybe enlightening to kind of look at a family that really intentionally gave up a lot of material good and gave up living off credit and all these things and just shaped this new life. And it just seemed like kind of an interesting story that would feed into what was then sort of a national conversation of, you know, is America changing its ways? Will we go to low credit? Will we be happy with fewer things? And it just seemed like a really interesting way to kind of look at that whole conversation. And so we wrote that article and posted it on our website at mynorth.com. And it turned out it was one of our most highly read articles for several months running, even years running. It was just right there at the top. And there's just a lot of interest in that topic. And so as I was kind of thinking about a book to write, I thought, why not do this topic? It's a really interesting topic. It seemed very worthy of my life energies, which was important to me. And so I talked to Bill, the main subject of the book, and he was on board, and you know, we pushed it forward.
You know, I wondered when I first came across your book if it was aligning with that trend that we're seeing today with generally simplifying life, minimalism, tiny homes, that kind of a thing. Was that your sense of why it seemed to catch fire so quickly?
I think so. Yeah, I really do. And like you say, that is very much part of our national conversation right now. And you know, and we didn't write it with the idea that everyone's going to become Amish, but I think it just serves as a great way to sort of contemplate all those decisions that we might be facing, like, do I want less technology in my life? Do I want a more manageable life, even with my time or the size of my house or, you know, all of that? So I think it's just, it's just something about the story that lets people think about their own lives.
Unplugging, I think. Isn't that the term that we use, that we want to get unplugged?
That's right. Yeah, right. So they unplugged in a very dramatic way. That's right.
You know, I was fascinated when I first came across your title because I thought, you know, I hear about it going in the other direction of people from the Amish community, usually young people who are very curious and maybe a little more rebellious, wanting to come into general society. I'm not sure I'd ever come across the story in the direction that yours goes. Did you find that that was unusual or not?
It is pretty unusual. Yeah, my friend Bill says there might be 20 families a year that might do something like that. So I would say that it's quite rare.
20 families out of Michigan, or
like in America.
Okay,
and
oh,
again,
that's not
like a scientific study, but
understood.
But that was his, you know, impression. And the Amish across America are actually remarkably connected and share stories and events and all this thing. And so, you know, his number is probably not all that far off, actually. Yeah.
And that was something interesting that you addressed in your book, too, when we talk about unplugged, that in their community, without electricity, without social media and all those things that we're so used to today, the Amish are actually much more connected than we are. Talk about the sense of community.
That was one of my biggest takeaways. And I was so impressed by how their world still functions at such a human level. And my expectation was that I would find people who were kind of isolated and limited to their community and kind of the small world they lived in. And what I found was these people are just so connected in very, very human ways. And somehow, even though they keep it very, very human and face-to-face and one-on-one and all these things, somehow news and events and sense of caring and giving, all this runs through that community and nationwide very, very quickly. For example, when the Nickel Mines shooting, the school shooting in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, happened, my friends found out about that within minutes of it happening. And I suspect every other Amish person did as well. And they're also, their expectation in interactions, I think, is very different than ours. My friend might spend, you know, 30 nights a year staying in other people's homes, and other people stay in their home. And if you travel, it's very expected that, say, if you met somebody and hit it off with them somewhere, an Amish person, they would expect you to stay at their house, and they might be, you know, slightly even offended if you didn't, like, why didn't you stay with us? Whereas in our society, if someone called up and said, hey, I met you at this thing a couple times and I'm dropping by with my six kids, we're going to crash at your place for a few nights. Like, most people would be really taken aback by that, you know, but that is just very, very accepted. And so that idea of a culture still operating at a superhuman level and still being, it seems like, instantly in touch somehow, which is just an amazing thing. I don't know, that was just a huge takeaway. So
that's what struck me the most when I read the book, too, was that, that sense of community, that warmth, that hospitality, that we've really forgotten how to extend that to people. And I'm guilty of this myself. I'm wondering how many of you out there listening know all of your neighbors' names or even who they are. You know, it kind of makes you feel nostalgic when you read it.
Yeah, it does. And it made me contemplate the idea that we really are a kind of tribal species, and we are, we need community. And somehow I think in America today, with the kind of overriding media narrative of the solo successor person, right? The person that made it on their own, the self-made man, the self-made woman. It's like, if you read magazines and newspapers, it's that narrative over and over and over again. And we've almost forgotten, or we've kind of moved away from understanding that we're a community species, really. And I know there's a quote by Wendell Berry where he talks about this, where there's this human paradox that, in order to be whole as an individual, we need to be part of a community. And I think that idea was another gigantic takeaway for me. It was just really thinking about that and understanding maybe kind of how we've been duped a little bit by that that media narrative of the individual, you know, and we need to remember that community is essential to who we are.
So how did you get to know Bill? Give us a little bit of your personal history on how you were connected with the Mosers.
Well, that is a very long story, and because Bill and I met when we were each 4 years old on the Livonia, Michigan street that we grew up on, and we lived just a few doors apart, and we kind of moved into this brand new neighborhood with dirt lawns and, you know, houses being built around us, and our friendship was formed then. And as we grew, you know, we just did what boys do, and he was the best man in my wedding, and I was the best man at his wedding, and our friendship just stayed intact. So it goes back a long, long way. It's very, very deep. So yeah, that was a rich part of the book, was kind of reconnecting, doing a deep dive on that experience with him. Yeah.
Just to give our listeners a contrast, who was he before in terms of occupation and lifestyle? And then who did he and Tricia become? And the change was gradual.
Bill was an architect, and Tricia was an occupational therapist. They both went to college in Detroit, and when they got out of college, they hung out with what we'd now call the creative class. Back then, maybe we might have called them yuppies, and their careers kind of allowed them to move to Grosse Pointe and kind of just hang out with sort of the cool kids, if you will. And but Tricia first, more so than Bill, just kind of felt there was a certain lack in their life, and that lack stemmed from kind of a spiritual void that she felt at the time. And that actually caused some conflict in their marriage because Bill just wasn't really ready to go there yet, to become more religious and to make Christianity in particular a bigger part of his life. And so they kind of, you know, stayed in that zone for a while, but then Bill had a conversion experience himself and committed to Christianity, and they were part of mainstream Christian faith, but they kept evolving, and they kept wanting a simpler version of faith, a more direct connection, more literal interpretation of the Bible, and many of the things they sought, including this idea of a community of faith. That was a very big piece of it, but very much seeking a community of like-minded people just eventually led them to the Amish. It was nothing they set out to do. I think they were probably more surprised than anybody that they ended up there. But it worked for them at a lot of levels. And, of course, when they made that change, they had to change how they made a living. Tricia became a traditional Amish wife and did all the things that Amish wives do as far as canning and keeping the home. And Bill tried a couple different things, but the main thing they landed upon was building a palace. And this was in northern Michigan, not too far from Cadillacs.
You know, I'm wondering, too, as I'm hearing that there's something of a faith crisis in our country right now in terms of the numbers who attend church has been going down a lot. A lot of churches are actually closing. Did you see any kind of faith crisis among the Amish community, or are they holding healthy?
They are actually holding healthy, and I did want to get back to one thing you mentioned earlier about young people leaving. Their numbers are actually quite strong. Granted, they have large families, and as we said earlier, there's not a big influx into the Amish, but they tend to find that about 85 to 90% of people born Amish remain Amish.
Mm.
And there are certainly some people leaving, but for the most part, their numbers are growing actually very rapidly. And in the early 1900s, there were, you know, maybe like 20 or 30,000 Amish in America. And today there are nearly 300,000.
Wow.
And so their big families are pushing their number forward. And like I say, that retention rate is remarkably strong. I think just in talking with Bill and the other Amish people I met through them, I think I get the sense many Amish people do contemplate leaving as they come of age and and they're encouraged to kind of look outside their world and check out what's out there. And I remember one Amish gentleman said to me, you know, I thought about leaving, but I just kind of looked at what I'd be gaining versus what I'd be losing. And I just felt it wasn't worth it. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't worth it, you know? So they're doing well.
What would you say, after all the observation and interviewing and research that you've done, what would you say are the most common misconceptions about the Amish community?
I think the biggest one is that, and I had this myself, that this sense that they all live by the same set of technological rules, and everyone's real confused about what those rules are, and people tend to kind of look for inconsistencies in those rules to sort of maybe pick it apart or whatever. But there's actually a wide variety of technological rules that the Amish live by, and some are very, very simple, like they would not gravel their roads or mow their lawns, and others are not a whole lot different than mainstream America. They might drive cars, for example. They might have cell phones. So there's a great variety of technological difference there. I think another would be, and this is really important to me in writing the book, I think there is a sort of cartoon view of the Amish. Like, they're simple, aw shucks, simple folk, you know, and they're all kind of like this.
Yeah.
And they're, of course, no people are like that, right? But they dress the same, and they have these, you know, they ride horse and buggies. And so we tend to just assume things about them, and they tend to be this sort of simplistic vision. And I think that would be one very important takeaway that I was hoping to convey anyway, is that, of course, they're not that. They're individuals, they're humans, they're as diverse in their personality as any other people would be. You know, they're just adhering to this system of beliefs and dress and cultural restrictions. So
now the Mosers had children. Tell us a little bit more about how the kids responded to this change of going from one world to the other.
You know, that was also a really interesting thing. We lost touch with the Mosers a little bit, and my wife and I moved to Minneapolis. We lived there 13 years, and the Mosers stayed in Michigan. And just probably the last 3-4 years, we just weren't in touch, really. And so when we came back, that's when we discovered they were Amish. We didn't really have any idea. And so when we reconnected in a then planned visit and went down, I expected to find their kids to be like shy and maybe kind of confused and shell-shocked by this really unusual move that their parents did, and or even, you know, just very quiet, because that was my perception of the Amish way. And what I found was the children are so remarkably confident and so remarkably engaged in conversation and culturally and with the world that that was actually one of the biggest surprises to me. And then as they grew older and kind of moved into work and that sort of thing, you know, they don't go to school beyond eighth grade, but one of them is running a trust building company. Another one is a partner in a metal roofing company. Another is learning to take over a family lumber yard. But their daughter, they have one daughter, is teaching out at a Mennonite school in Idaho. And so, oh, and another one is working at an orphanage in El Salvador. Mm. And so I guess my sense was, you know, again, getting back to misperceptions, you think, oh, education stops in the eighth grade. They live in these closed communities. Of course, they have a small world ahead of them, or they're part of the small world. And I just found that to be very much not the case. They're, you know, just confident, entering the world in a really great way. And that was a big surprise to me, and it was an awesome thing to see, and their kids are really great.
In hindsight, when you think about it now, I would think, you know, maybe it's not surprising because of the way that the youth are nurtured and the connections they have with the adults around them all day long.
You know, I think you're right on there. They have, I think, that confidence and that willingness to take on the world comes from just being so grounded and feeling so safe in their world. You know, like, our parents love us, our community is taking care of us, we're safe, we can take risks and, you
exactly.
know, and do stuff.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Did you yourself come away with any personal insights or changes, or did the experience of working on this book change you in any way?
Well, I think the biggest things were some of the things I've touched on as far as understanding within me the need for community and being intentional about being part of community. And I haven't done any huge things like join the Kiwanis Club or something like that, but I'm trying to really be aware when someone, say, invites me to some community thing or some party or some local neighborly gathering or whatever.
Yeah.
Kind of err on the side of saying yes, showing up, you know, offering to help and things like that. I think another is just trying to be aware of human scale interaction and trying to be aware of how technology, we can kind of be, you know, tricked into thinking technological connection is the same as really human connection, trying to be aware of that difference. And not that I'm going to leave all technology behind, but really trying to be aware of human to human connection and trying to make that a bigger, more intentional part of my life. I think, I think those would be the two biggest takeaways, you know, this community and that one-to-one connection thing.
Yeah, important lessons, I think, for all of us. I found myself feeling a little envious at times as I read the book.
I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. So where are the Mosers today? Catch us up a little bit.
So the Amish, they conduct their world speaking Pennsylvania German. And the Moseses were never quite able to grasp that. Their children were. Their children are fluent in Pennsylvania German. But Bill and Tricia just were not able to get there with it. And that barrier, just over the course of 15 years that they lived, of course, in Buggy Amish, just became too great. And one of the reasons it was too great is, you know, they were seeking a very nuanced understanding of the state. And when there's that constant language barrier, they just couldn't really, you know, go all the way with that. And to be fair, their church, you know, offered translators during the service, like real-time live translation as the service played out and things like that.
Yeah.
And they really worked with them. But that barrier proved too great, and they eventually left the Horse and Buggy Amish and moved to an Amish Mennonite church, is what they call it, in Missouri. And they left behind some of the technology restrictions when they did that. And so now they're driving cars. And but the statement of faith that the Amish and the Mennonite faiths are based on, this kind of core statement of faith, is still the same. And so they still have that same set of beliefs, if you will.
Well, it was a absolutely fascinating book to read, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk. Thank you, Jeff.
Me too. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate this opportunity. It's always fun to share that story.